gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Welcome. It's a full house tonight, and I'm very pleased. Please also for our lecturer, Charles Ray. This is an Asian Study Group event, but I can see that a lot of people are not Asian Study Group members yet, so I hope you can join if you like to. We have a table at the back. And we also sell some of our publications, but you can also join or buy our publications in three places in town: London Bookshop Company, Side Book Bank, Mr. Books, and I forgot one again.
The office.
The office of the Asian Study Office. So tonight is very special because my colleague Dorothy has been suggesting that Charles Ray did this presentation almost over a year ago, and we could never get hold of her because she's very busy with her work, traveling all over the place, and I'd given it up on it, and suddenly Charles Ray was available. So it's a very real privilege and a treat to have her tonight, even more than we expected. I will not talk about Rumi because she will do better than I can, but it's for me a treat because I was reading this afternoon actually that Rumi was only discovered in the 20th century in the West and in America, and it was also discovered that there was a French scholar who has become a translator and quite important translator for French readers. So it's very special because he's such a unique person that he was not known outside the I would say Urdu, Farsi, Arabic speaking world, Turkish speaking world. So I will just say a few words for those who don't know Charles Ray. She's a student of Sufism. She's been in Sufism for over 25 years, and she's part of the Rumi circle in Islamabad. She holds diplomas in English literature from Brian Moore College in the USA and another diploma from the University of Cambridge in the UK. She's been working for the last few years as a development consultant and on poverty, gender, and gender issues across various sectors. And that's why she's always traveling and very little available to us. So please enjoy this evening. Charles Ray, please.
Assalamu alaikum. What a joy it is to be here with the lovers of Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi and those who may be just about to fall in love with him. Let me welcome you with the words of the great Sufi poet Abu Sa'id. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshipper, lover of leaving, ours is not a caravan of despair. Come, even if you have broken your vow 1,000 times, come, yet again, come, come. I would like to express my gratitude to the Asian Study Group for organizing this event, and particularly to Dorothy Blaine. Dorothy, where are you? For what I can only call her monumental assistance. Also to Michelle and Parveen Malik and Hilary. I would also like to acknowledge my indebtedness to my Sufi teachers and my dear companions in the Rumi circle, but for whom this unworthy one would not be standing here. I have to begin with a confession. My original intention was to speak to you as a lover of Maulana Rumi, but then fear set in, and all my academic training came and perched on my shoulder, and I pulled out all the books that I had about Maulana Rumi, the definitive Franklin Lewis, the Rumi past, present, east, west, the teachings of Maulana Rumi, his poetry, Anna Marie Schimmel's books, Two Colored Brocade, Shafiq Jan's Fundamentals of Rumi's Thought. So I pulled all these books out, Sheikh Kabir and Sheikha Kamil Helminski's translations of Rumi's poetry, and I started researching and writing a lecture. So I wrote a 15-page lecture, and after I'd done that, I invited a friend to come and hear it. and she obliged, and she listened to me patiently. After it finished, she said, "But where is your heart in all this?" And to seal her point, she quoted Bulle Shah, "Pad pad ilm hazar kitabaan, kade apne aap nu padhya hi nahi. Ja ja varde mandar masiti, kade dil apne vich vadhya hi nahi." So she said to me, "Well, you can go ahead with this, but this is what I think. And all this knowledge that you're giving me, or information," she called it, "I could get with one click on the internet." I assured her that all these carefully collected jewels could not be obtained with one click on the internet. These were the fruits of painstaking research. But there was a voice in my own heart which said, "You are hiding behind the mask of a scholar. Who dare to speak as a lover?" So, what came to me in that moment was a story about the first encounter between Maulana Rumi and Hazrat Shams. Maulana Rumi was sitting with all his books, teaching his students, and Hazrat Shams arrived. By all accounts, a fierce, wild, and intense-looking dervish. He pointed to Maulana's books and said, "What is this?" Maulana looked at him and said, "You won't understand." So Shams picked up all of Maulana's books and threw them into the pool. Maulana was devastated at this barbarity, the loss of his rare and precious books. "What have you done?" he cried. Shams looked at him intently and then silently took one book out after another, with not a drop of water on them. Maulana said, "What is this?" Shams said, "You will not understand." This mythical encounter captures a truth about the relationship between Maulana and Shams, as myths often do. Shams made Maulana throw away his books literally and metaphorically. And as my Sufi teacher Khadim Chishti says, Rumi had to die to his identity as a jurist and a scholar to be born as a lover and nightingale of God. Maulana says, "Since the spark of love entered my heart, its fire devoured all else. I set aside books and intellect and learnt poetry, songs, and chorals. I thought, how can I claim to be a lover of Maulana and not even have learnt this lesson? Listen to your own heart. Listen to the voice inside you." Maulana's epic begins with, "Bishno inne chun hikayat mikunat. Bishno inne chun hikayat mikunat. Az judai ha shikayat mikunat." Listen to the flute. Listen to the stories it tells. Listen to its lament of separation. So I put aside my books, my carefully crafted 15-page lecture, and with a few days to go, began to look inside my own heart and the hearts of my beloved companions in the Rumi circle. We have been gathering every Thursday for the last 5 years to study the Masnavi with the blessings of Sheikh Kabir and Sheikh Kamil Helminski of the Threshold Mevlevi Sufi Order. Now, since I'm speaking as a lover, there's an occupational hazard lovers faced. The heart can melt into tears and the voice can break at any time. I told my friend this and she said that this may happen, and she said, "That is just crazy." I said, "Well, love is pretty crazy." Maulana said, "I'm drunk and you're insane. Who's going to take us home?" I would like to share with you today what it is that about Rumi that has made us fall in love with him, that has made people from different cultures, people of different colors, faiths, religions fall in love with him. His son Walad wrote, "People of every faith proved faithful to him, in love with him, people of all nations." This has remained true from the 13th century to the 21st, from Indonesia to the USA. I would also today like to offer you a taste of the Masnavi and our experience in reading the Masnavi. Something about Rumi and me. I started reading about Sufism when I was 14, and I've been on the Sufi path essentially for, I calculated, over 30 years, cooking very, very slowly. I was in the Naqshbandi order, and I'm very grateful for all the teachings that I received in this order. But there was one question that was running like a ticker through my head. What is this love that the Sufis talk about? What is it that made Rabia Basri say, "I will not worship God like a laborer in expectation of wages"? What made Halaj go laughing to the gallows? What made Bulle Shah tie bells to his feet and dance? What made Rumi and Lal Shahbaz Qalandar whirl in ecstasy? What made Hafiz sing like a nightingale? Many years passed, I learnt much, but I didn't find the answer to my question. I did turn to Rumi. I picked up collections of his poems. I picked up the Masnavi. But despite the fact that I have one degree in literature and another in applied linguistics, and I've taught poetry, I couldn't relate to it. I couldn't really make any sense of it. It was very humbling because I remember thinking, even Madonna understands Rumi. But I can't. So, on a family holiday in 2009, I went off all by myself, nobody else wanted to come, to visit Maulana Rumi's shrine. I met a lover of Maulana's at the shrine, a complete stranger to me, but she kept me company all day. She didn't speak any English and I didn't speak any Turkish, but a spontaneous friendship developed. Some time passed, and quite magically, I came into contact with another person who was in love with Rumi, my dear Sufi teacher, Khadim Chishti. I'm thinking love must be contagious, and it must unlock another kind of understanding within one's heart, because now when I turned to Rumi, his words and his poetry began to resonate in my heart. At the end of the year, I found myself attending a retreat of the Mevlevi order led by Sheikh Kabir and Sheikha Kamil. And there, in their presence, immersed in Rumi's poetry and teaching, music and Sema, the sacred whirling, I finally had a glimpse of that love, that incredible, indescribable force that permeates this universe. This, my friends, is the gift that Rumi can give you. Glimpses and experiences of that incredible love, the life force that blurs the distinction between animate and inanimate, vegetable, mineral, animal, human, that experience of interconnectedness, the oneness of all that exists. Rumi says in the Masnavi, "Love is the astrolabe of God's mysteries." Astrolabe, as you may know, is the instrument that was used to plot the positions of the stars and navigate the seas in medieval times. It literally means one who catches the stars. Maulana says, "Love is the astrolabe of God's mysteries. A lover may be drawn to this love or that love, but finally he is drawn to the Sultan of love. However much we describe and explain love, when we fall in love, we are ashamed of our words. Explanation by the tongue makes most things clear, but love unexplained is clearer. When the pen came to the subject of love, it broke. When the discourse reached the topic of love, the pen split and the paper tore. If intellect tries to explain it, it falls helpless as a donkey on a muddy trail. Only love itself can explain love and lovers. The proof of the sun is the sun itself. If you wish to see it, don't turn away from it. Love, they think you are both angelic and human. They think you are more potent than the seal of Solomon. They think you are the life force within the body of the universe. But the way I live with you is not what they think. Love cannot be carried or contained in words. Love's an ocean of unfathomed depth. Infinite, the ocean's drops of water. Yet the ocean, tiny next to love. The paradox is that love is impossible to talk about, but there really isn't anything else worth talking about. As Rumi makes us live in what a Christian mystic, Thomas Merton, called the belly of the paradox. He points to something beyond our limited ways of understanding ourselves and the world around us. He induces in us a state of wonder. The correct word, or the best word for it, would be aporia. Aporia means bewilderment. And Socrates said that aporia is the source of philosophy. Philosophy in the original sense of the word, love of wisdom. Rumi tells us that each human being has the potential to function as a mirror for the divine. The divine can be seen not only in other human beings, but in all of creation, all that exists. The challenge for each human being is to reflect the divine by becoming an embodiment of love and compassion. And for that to happen, we have to educate and purify our hearts. How do we do this? Rumi says, Heech kaz aspi shikhut cheezi nashut. Heech ahan khanjare teezi nashut. Maulavi harkiz nashut maulai rum. Ta hulame shamsi tabrizi nashut. There is nothing that becomes something all by itself. Iron does not turn into a sharp dagger all by itself. I would never have become Maulana-i Rum had I not become the slave of Shams-e Tabrizi. Rumi unlocks for us the treasures of spiritual friendship as a way of acquiring self-knowledge and wisdom. It was the encounter with Shams, an uncompromising, intense, wandering dervish, that turned the 37-year-old Jalaluddin Rumi, Jalaluddin he was at that time, a well-traveled, well-educated, highly respected Islamic scholar, into a lover of God, whirling in ecstasy to music and poetry. After meeting Shams, Rumi composed over 60,000 lines of verse, lyrical poems, ghazals and qasidas, quatrains, and an epic called the Masnavi. This is more than was ever written by Homer or Milton or Shakespeare. Rumi's poetry is considered some of the finest poetry in Persian. This is especially remarkable because he was not a professional poet. He composed most of it spontaneously, and yet he manages to follow the rules and the diction quite perfectly. What was the nature of this friendship that set Rumi with Shams, that set Rumi's heart on fire? Rumi said, I burned, I burned, I burned. What was burning? What led to the outpouring of poetry? Shams did not just throw Rumi's books into the well. He threw Rumi into the well of his own self. Stripped of all his masks, Rumi turned away from his false self to find the divine within him. This was the gift that Shams gave him. Shams tells us that Rumi would sit in front of him as if he was 4 years old and knew nothing, as if he was a convert, new convert to Islam. Such utter submissiveness. What was this about? We can only read the book of ourselves when we empty ourselves of all that we think we know. Maulana developed a most profound humility and profound compassion, which can only come from letting go all the masks that we hide behind. And Shams was Maulana's trainer. One day, Shams told Rumi to go and buy wine, and bring it back. Can you imagine what it was like for a respected Islamic scholar to walk into a tavern and then walk through the streets of Konya carrying a carafe of wine? The people of Konya were shocked. They ridiculed him. They mocked him. Some say that a rival jurist came and pulled off Maulana's cloak and turban, calling him a hypocrite and a charlatan who was preaching one thing and doing another. Rumi was finally rescued by Shams, but not before he had shown him the illusory nature of reputation. This was why Rumi loved Shams immensely. The divine, he had rescued him from his limited self and shown him his essential self, the divine spirit within him. Shams was a mirror in which Rumi contemplated the divine, and Rumi was a mirror for Shams. This was not a conventional Sufi sheikh disciple relationship. Shams himself said that God had not created the being who could be Rumi's teacher. And he said, "I come for friendship." Shams and Rumi spent less than 3 years together. In between, Shams left one, Rumi's entreaties brought him back, and then he left again, never to return. Rumi's poetry reflected his devastation at losing his beloved spiritual companion. Rumi's Diwan, the collection of his lyrical poems, is known as Diwan-e-Shams Tabriz. Rumi's nom de plume, or takhallus for most of the poems, is Shams-e-Tabriz, or Khamosh, silence. I want to pause here to provide a signpost. When Maulana composed his poetry, there was a 300-year-old tradition, convention of the poetry of praise in Persian literature. The beloved is an androgynous figure. Persian grammar does not differentiate between feminine and masculine. And for the Sufis, this points to the reality that gender itself is an earthly construct, one of little importance in the world of the spirit. On the other hand, Sufis often do conceive of the soul as feminine, because the feminine is a metaphor for receptivity. Zulaikha yearns for Joseph, so yearns the lover for God. Another intentional ambiguity is that one can never quite be sure whether the poet is referring to the divine beloved or an earthly beloved. According to an Arab proverb, the metaphor is the bridge to the truth. For the Sufis, love of an earthly being is a metaphorical love, which leads to genuine spiritual love. It is a poetic tradition, Sheikh Kabir tells us, to push metaphors of sensual love and intoxication to their limits to convey the overpowering nature of the encounter with the divine. And similarly, despite the blurring of the boundaries between the human and divine in poetry, the Sufis make a fastidious distinction between the servant and the Lord, the human being and God. Shams was not the only one who was a mirror in which Maulana contemplated the divine. There was Salahuddin Zarqubi, a goldsmith who was uneducated. I would say goldsmith with no education, forgive me. And Husamuddin Chelebi, the one who requested Maulana to compose something like the Masnavi and was the scribe of the Masnavi. Maulana said, "Shams is the sun, Salahuddin is the moon, and Husamuddin is the stars. They will all guide you to God." The heart melts at Maulana's humility, because although both were in a way his disciples, he speaks of them as if they were his masters. The Masnavi opens with a panegyric to Husamuddin, and Rumi says about Salahuddin, "He is the candle, and I am the bowl into which he drips." I would like to share with you some of my favorite stories about Maulana before going on to the Masnavi. A famous and learned priest came to meet Maulana from Constantinople. By coincidence, he met him on the way. The priest bowed his head down to the ground 30 times. When he looked up, he saw Maulana was also putting his head to the ground 33 times. The priest was overcome and he said, "O king of religion, such modesty and such humility, is a poor priest like me worthy of such respect?" Maulana responded by saying, The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is our master and sultan. And he said, blessed is the person who keeps his humility in spite of having honor and respect. When I am the follower of such a prophet, how can I not show humility to the slaves of God? And if I have no humility, for whom and for what would I be good? In a world in which one's creed is considered to be the only way to salvation, the following exchange is particularly poignant. One day, Maulana said, I am with all 72 different sects and creeds, referring to the 72 sects of Islam. A man who wanted to discredit Maulana sent a jurist to his gathering, telling him to ascertain if Maulana in fact had said this and to curse him and insult him if he had. The jurist confronted Rumi. It has been claimed that you said, I am with 72 different sects and creeds. Maulana said, yes, that is true. The jurist began to swear at him and insult him. Maulana just smiled and said, despite what you're saying, I am with you too. His compassion embraced all kinds of creatures. A bull, it is said, once came and hid behind him, and he asked the butchers to set him free. One of his students reported that one day Maulana asked me to buy a khutab, a meat dish. He took it from me and rolled it up in a napkin and went off. I quietly followed him. I saw a litter of puppies with their mother. Maulana gave her all the food. When Maulana saw me, he said, for 7 days and nights, this poor creature has not eaten anything, and she cannot leave because of her little ones. God conveyed her entreaties to my ears and ordered me to console her. This is the Rumi through whom the Masnavi came to us. Divine light refracted through the prism of this deeply compassionate, selfless saint who looked upon all religions, all peoples, and in fact all of creation as waves from the ocean of love, the ocean of unity. Rumi maintained that the Masnavi was a manifestation of divine grace through him. He would recite it, and Husamuddin would sing it back to him for his confirmation and approval. Rumi called the Masnavi the heart's paradise, the cure for breasts, and the purge for sorrows, and the expounder of the Quran, and the abundance of gifts, and the cleanser of dispositions, where the righteous eat and drink, and there the free are gladdened and rejoiced. He called it the shop of unity. The poet Jami called it the Quran in Persian. Annemarie Schimmel, the great German scholar and lover of Maulana, described the Masnavi as a wondrous tree that has produced strange blossoms and fruits, a tree in which birds of different hues are nesting until they leave the nest world and fly back to their eternal home. My teacher, Khadim Chishti, calls it a turbulent sea in which you are tossed this way and that. Your notions of what it is to be alive, what it is to love, what it is to be human, what is real, what is illusory, are challenged. Much has been said in praise of the Masnavi. I found it fascinating to learn that Hindu Brahmins in the 1500s were reciting the Masnavi in Bengal. Masnavi-e-Manavi. Masnavi is a particular form of rhymed couplet, a long poem, and Manavi means inner meaning, the couplets of inner meaning. It's a rich tapestry of stories interrupted by parables, by jokes, anecdotes, and vignettes. Many of the stories are from such sources as Kalila and Dimne, the Persian translation of the Panchtantra. Few are Maulana's own. Yet, very much like Shakespeare, it has been said that he borrows much but owes little. His treatment of every story is so original. Allama Iqbal, who considered Rumi his spiritual master, wrote, three people have been gifted with the capacity to render the states of the soul in stories. They are Jesus Christ, Jalaluddin Rumi, and William Shakespeare. The Masnavi has no overarching narrative, but it is held together by recurrent themes which appear and disappear, such as love, illusion and reality, form and meaning, free will and predestination. But each time a theme appears and reappears, it is from a slightly different perspective. And the world of the Masnavi is teeming with all kinds of characters and creatures, prophets and saints, tyrants and brigands, the helpless fly, the feeble spider, the humble ant, the sugar-eating parrot, and the little chickpea. Each represents a state of the soul. Each holds up a mirror to the reader, each inviting the reader to a deeper understanding of the self and a higher aspiration. The world of the Masnavi is charged with the grandeur of God. Nothing is too insignificant to be a sign that points beyond itself to the One. Now you may be thinking that sounds pretty chaotic, but there is a certain heuristic method that has been used in different esoteric traditions in different ways. Zen Buddhists have used koans, paradoxical statements or parables, to develop a deeper understanding of the self and the nature of reality. Similarly, the Masnavi uses perspective shifts and unresolved paradoxes to expose the self-serving and limited nature of our thought processes, of our understanding. Its stories and parables and rhythm and rhyme lodge themselves in our subconscious, altering our perceptions. Rumi says, "If you remain in forms, you are an idol worshipper. Pass beyond the form and behold the meaning." Two different things, the sea's eye and its form. Forget form. See with the eye of the sea. All surging of that form comes from the sea. How strange! You look to form and see no sea. He teaches us through innumerable parables and stories and jokes to see the oneness, the unity that underlies the multiplicity. There is a story in the Masnavi about a Jewish king who decides to exterminate the Christians. Rumi tells us that the king could not see that Moses and Jesus were one. After a few lines, the story is interrupted by a parable. A master said to a squinting student, "Come here and bring me that bottle." Said the squint-eyed one, "Which of the bottles shall I bring to you? Let me know." "There aren't two bottles," said the master. "Stop squinting, don't double them." "Oh, master," he said, "don't scold me." The master replied, "Okay, then smash one of them." The bottle was one, though to his eyes it seemed two. And when he broke that bottle, nothing was left. When one was broken, both vanished from sight. Anger and lust make a man squint. They cloud the spirit so it strays from truth. When self-interest appears, virtue hides. 100 veils rise between the heart and the eye. This parable gives us a perspective on the story that is unfolding. It works at many levels and raises many questions, but here is one interpretation. The master, the divine spark, the heart within us, knows that there is only one reality, that we are all interconnected. But there's another part of us that is squint-eyed due to anger, greed, self-interest, and this part insists on our separateness. It thinks it can shatter the other and preserve itself. Maulana tells us that there is no other. When you harm another person, you have shattered what is most valuable in you, your humanity. The story proceeds, and we are told that the king has a vizier, a prime minister. This one advises him to use deceit rather than force. He then tells the king to disfigure him so that the Christians think he has fallen out of favor and will accept him as one of their own. Aha! So when you have an intention even just an intention to harm someone, what happens? You are willingly disfiguring yourself. This is just one dimension of what reflection on these stories and parables does. And because these are stories and parables, they lodge themselves into your subconscious and spring out at opportune moments. Next time someone does something to me and I begin to react by wanting at least to send them a malicious little thought, I think, do I really want to disfigure myself? And then you come across another passage from a slightly different perspective. The mention of Moses has tied up your thoughts. You think these are stories that happened a long time ago. Talking about Moses is a mask. The light of Moses is your real concern. Moses and Pharaoh are both within you. You need to look for these two adversaries within yourself. The birthing from Moses continues until the resurrection. Even though each lamp may seem different, the light is the same. This clay lamp and its wick may appear to be different, but the light isn't. It comes from beyond. If you keep looking at the glass of the lamp, you'll be lost, because it's from the glass that multiplicity is seen. Keep focusing on the light, so you'll be free of duality and the multiplicity of colors of this limited body. Friends, the Masnavi is like an ocean. If there were world enough and time, you could keep diving in and keep bringing out pearl upon pearl. My talk would not be complete if I didn't bring to you the voices of my beloved companions in the Rumi circle. Maulana says, any life lived apart from spiritual companions is lifelessness and sleep in your essence. So here are some words from the Rumi circle on reading the Masnavi. The Masnavi said to me, Akal ke madrasse se ut, ishq ke mai kade naya. Leave the school of the intellect, come to the tavern of love. The Masnavi has healed me. It's as if I'm traveling through a desert and the Masnavi is an oasis where I can rest. It has transformed my experience of love. I started reading the Masnavi and painted my first darvish. And these darvishes that you see all around have been painted by an artist in our circle. I have become so much more patient. I don't get angry like I used to. People say, what happened to you? It makes me feel intoxicated with joy. Now, when there is some hardship, I think, wow, there must be so many hidden treasures in this. I want to fly with the Masnavi. The Masnavi is so inclusive and expansive, it expands the heart. I feel like the Masnavi is a companion walking with me in this journey of life. I learned from the Masnavi that this life is a journey of love towards Allah, our only love. The Masnavi has had a transformative effect on me. Maulana speaks to my heart and soul, replacing fear with love and despair with hope. The Masnavi is a companion in a many-colored coat, accompanying me on this journey of life, telling me stories, speaking to me, challenging me, expanding my heart. Finally, I reached out to a dear Darvish across the seven seas who has been reading the Masnavi every day for the last 17 years. She said, it's like entering a most beautiful place, full of love, peace. Oops, I've lost my place. Okay, she said, it's like entering a most beautiful place, full of love, full of peace, full of calm and wisdom. Every time I go to it, there's something new. It's fresh. It never gets old. And I keep absorbing wisdom from it slowly in different shapes. So, dear friends, the Masnavi has been a wonderful companion in our quest to be fully human. And I hope that you too can dive into this ocean of unity and love and bring out the pearls that are there. Thank you very much. we have some time for questions and answers. I would just like to acknowledge that there are real scholars here. There's Dr. Marcia Hendelson from the professor of Islamic Studies from Loyola University. There is Dr. Komel, and I don't know if Dr. Jawad Hamdani is here, but there are scholars here as well, real scholars. So if you have any questions, we can answer those, and then we would like to end by having Sifat read out a poem of Maulana's to you. He started in the 12, I'm a little rusty on my dates, but 1260s. My memory is bad, but I think it was in the 1260s that he started dictating it. And it flowed from then. There's controversy about, you know, when exactly it started, but 1260s is fine. And then till his death, I mean, 1273. So he was composing it, but it shows that he had planned 6 books. And they are supposed to represent the 6 directions, up, down, right, left. They're supposed to represent the 6 directions as well. But in between it was interrupted, the second book, because it was Husamuddin whom he would dictate it to. And Husamuddin withdrew for a short time, his wife died, and Maulana stopped composing. And it was only when he came back that he started composing again. But if anyone knows the exact dates,
thank you for enlightening and very persuasive that people will follow and read the Muslim anyway. I have 2 questions. One is that regarding the social turmoil at
yes.
the time of the
yes.
Rumi, what was look like? I mean,
okay. Well,
and the second question
yeah.
is, you talk about the circle. What's the qualification to get into that circle?
Circle we can talk about later.
Okay.
I don't want to be seen to be proselytizing here. But about the turmoil, yes, he lived in very turbulent times. In fact, it is said that his father, the family was living in a place called Vakhsh, which is in Tajikistan. It's near Balkh, though he's called Balkhi. They weren't actually living in the city of Balkh. And they left that place when Maulana was a toddler because one of the theories is because his father had a premonition that the Mongol hordes were advancing, and they did. And Genghis Khan, I mean, we have a history teacher sitting there nodding. So Genghis Khan and his hordes did wreak devastation. And then they moved to Samarkand, and then that city was besieged by Khwarazm Shah. And then they left Samarkand. And it was over a period of 10 years of traveling that after which Maulana and his family finally settled in Konya. And I think Konya was also besieged once, but that was averted. The disaster was averted.
Very much for that very, very stirring and moving presentation. So much to ponder. So my question is a little sort of different. Having immersed yourself in this deeply spiritual journey, has it had any effect on just your work in the field of as a development consultant, on gender, on so many other issues and the turmoil that we face today? And do you think, from your own experience, that this could actually be a solution to so many of the issues we've struggled with together on this?
Well, very briefly, I think that it cannot but have an impact on everything that one does. And I think that the most important thing I would say is that everything that we do, every dialogue that we have, it has to be done with love. We cannot solve the world's problems by, you know, speaking the language of hate and contempt for anybody really. And I hope that whatever work I do, that love and compassion are, you know, my core values, and that this helps me to be more loving and more compassionate. And that, I think, has an impact on whatever one does, to the extent that one is able to be that. Thank you.
There are a number of translations of Mr. Rumi in the market, both in English as well as in Urdu. Which one would you recommend, in your view, as the best, both in English and Urdu?
Okay. Well, there are scholars here to whom I'm going to refer this question as well. But as far as I'm concerned, it depends what you're looking for. If you read Coleman Barks, that's very poetic, but he also takes poetic license. In Frank Lewis, I'm a little bit of awkward position because Sheikh Kabir and Sheikha Kamil are my teachers. But really, if you want to read an accurate and poetic translation of Maulana Rumi, I would certainly recommend their work. But there are others, as you know, you can enjoy Coleman Barks. Then there is a very good translation of the first book of the Masnavi, Listen, with a commentary by Kenan Rifai, who himself was a great spiritual teacher. So that's available. And in Urdu, of course, you have Sajjad Haider. Can somebody just confirm this, Farah? Sajjad Haider ki hai na translation?
Yeah,
ji. Sajjad Haider ki translation hai. Aur Urdu mein to mujhe bas wohi pata hai. But you have Nicholson in English, which I would recommend because it's very faithful to the original text. He has left out some parts of the Masnavi because he just found them not quite to his taste. But other than that, and we have Dr. Tanveer here. Dr. Tanveer, is there anything else that you would want to recommend?
I think that's enough.
That's enough? Okay.
Moment, but I would like to say
yeah.
Just one thing.
The mic, please.
Coleman's translation is bereft of that Sufi taste.
Yeah.
It's a kind of de-Sufiized way of translating it.
Yeah.
The text.
That's right. Yeah, he takes a lot of liberties. It's very poetic, but he takes a lot of liberties.
What was the name of the two scholars you recommended? Sorry.
There is Nicholson.
You mentioned two scholars you studied with.
Sheikha Kamil Helminski and Kabir Helminski. The Rumi Daybook and the Pocket Rumi are available at Said Book.
Thank you.
And for the entire Masnavi, Nicholson.
Can you please tell us about the relationship between Allama Iqbal and Maulana Rumi?
I can't tell you too much because it's not something I have studied, or I can only tell you, and maybe Dr. Tanveer can say something about it, or Dr. Komel, because Professor Komel is here, and maybe he can say a little bit. But he considered him his spiritual master, and it was a very deep, loving relationship. And I can tell you that when I went to Konya, and this was, I couldn't find it this time, but quite some years ago in 2009, there was actually a marble plaque there which said that this is to commemorate Allama Iqbal and his love for Maulana Rumi. Professor Saab, you want to say something? Khulasatan? Kuch bhi. Do teen lafz. Nahin, mere kya? Main to kuch nahi jaanti.
Shukriya, main Pakistan ki zuban mein bolunga. Iqbal ke, agar hum dekhe, Iqbal saare ka saara Rumi se hi bana hua hai. Khud wo baar baar iska, ek to ye ki unki masnaviyan dekhe to saare Rumi ke behar mein hai. Phir agar hum Javed Nama mein dekhe, to Murid-e-Hindi aur jo Peer-e Rumi hai, usme masnavi ka ang hai aur kahin kahin masnavi ke misre bhi liye. Aur baar baar inhone kaha, Peer-e Rumi khaak raakh sir kar. Rumi ne matti ko sona bana diya.
So, ek second main baakiyon ko bhi bata dun, that really Rumi has been the fundamental source of inspiration for Iqbal. And Iqbal said that Rumi turned dust into gold. So, So it was a very deep relationship. Anything else before we move on?
I would like to share a little understanding that I have gathered from various readings.
Please.
Is that the whole focus is on what we are translating as love. The background of all these personalities is Islam. So the concept of love in Islam has to be taken into consideration. The term that is used, what we call love in English, is muhabbat, which comes from the root word hub, which means a seed, or even smaller than that, a very, very small speck, I think would be a better explanation. So, muhabbat is a speck, and the muhib, the one who loves, the lover, has to reduce himself to a speck, while his love, the beloved, has to actually be the entire canvas.
That's right.
And this is the concept of muhabbat. And Allah Ta'ala says that I am the only entity which is worthy of your love. It is not any person, anything, your children, anything of this world, not even the prophets. It is me who is worthy, where you reduce yourself to a mere speck.
Thank you.
So the concept, when you apply this to all the poetry or the philosophy of Rumi, you will see that that's the reason that they reduce themselves to nothingness and the humbleness that you feel in them. Thank you.
I just want to say that there is no doubt that finally, as Maulana says, all love is finally directed to the Sultan of Love. But at the same time, each and every aspect of creation is a reflection of that love. It's a reflection, but in each and every aspect of creation, that love is manifest. Okay, I think, okay, please. Professor Tanveer.
Just Tanveer. Please say a few words on the transformation of temporal love to divine love, especially in the light of Rumi's teachings.
Okay.
How that transformation
happens. Would you like to say something about it? Please.
No, I'm asking you. Today I'm a speaker. I'm a listener and you're the speaker. But so please, I would love to hear you.
Well, this is my limited understanding. But the whole journey is really to discover that there is finally no, just the one. You know, there's that famous story about the lover comes to the beloved and knocks on the door and says, and the beloved says, "Who is it?" And the lover says, "It is I." And the beloved says, "There's no room here for you and me." So it's this journey. For Maulana, this whole spiritual friendship, this concept of spiritual friendship, is that you find a mirror in which you find the divine reflected. And that, in a way, is a beginning. And as you proceed, finally, Maulana, for example, said, with regard to Shams, that now I have found Shams inside myself. So it's this journey from an externalizing of the object of love to an internalizing and to realizing that there is no other. La ilaha illallah. There is just the one. And there is, love is sort of this force field that we are all in and all connected through. I do want to say one thing, that I spoke about how Maulana was transformed into a lover of God and he was whirling in ecstasy. I don't want to misrepresent Maulana, because at the same time he was undertaking rigorous spiritual practices. He would spend nights praying. He would fast day after day. So he remained a very devout Muslim. And yet what he said was that if you really know your own religion, that then you will see that the others too are paths to Allah. If you can know your own religion, you'll see that each and every one in creation is on a path towards Allah, because there are so many paths. And it's only when you have a limited understanding of your own religion that you want to go and exterminate others and spread hate and destruction and violence. Okay, one last question, and then I'm going to ask Siddharth to read the poem, because I know we are supposed to be closing up.
Not exactly a question, but a comment. Thank you very much, Shazre, for a very beautiful talk. There's a book by Nicholson about Rumi, titled The King's Falcon.
Okay.
And it is, as you place the falcon on your head in the morning and it leaves, and it soars the whole day. So the king is Allah or God, and falcon is our spirit. The king also knows that it will return to me in the evening, and the falcon also knows it will be home.
Thank you so much. That is so beautiful. Thank you so much. And on that note, let me invite Siddharth to come and read a poem to us.
Assalamualaikum, everybody. The poem that I'm going to read has been selected by Shazre, and I can guess why, because I think it's quintessential Maulana Rumi. It's been translated by Sheikh Kabir, and it is entitled The Ruby. At breakfast tea, a beloved asked her lover, "Who do you love more, yourself or me? From my head to my foot, I have become you. Nothing remains of me but my name. You have your wish. Only you exist. I've disappeared like a drop of vinegar in an ocean of honey. A stone which has become a ruby is filled with the qualities of the sun. No stoniness remains in it. If it loves itself, it is loving the sun. And if it loves the sun, it is loving itself. There is no difference between these two loves. Before the stone becomes the ruby, it is its own enemy. Not one, but two exist. The stone is dark and blind to daylight. If it loves itself, it is unfaithful. It intensely resists the sun. If it says I, it is all darkness. A pharaoh claims divinity and is brought down. Her large says the same and is saved. One eye is cursed, another eye is blessed. One eye is a stone, another a crystal. One an enemy of the light, the other a reflector of it. In its inmost consciousness, not through any doctrine, it is one with the light. Work on your stony qualities and become resplendent like the ruby. Practice self-denial and accept difficulty. Always see infinite life in letting the self die. Your stoniness will decrease, your ruby nature will grow. The signs of self-existence will leave your body, and ecstasy will take you over. Become all hearing like an ear, and gain a ruby earring. dig a well in the earth of this body, or even before the well is dug, let God draw the water up. Be always at work scraping the dirt from the well. To everyone who suffers, perseverance brings good fortune. The Prophet has said that each prostration of prayer is a knock on heaven's door. When anyone continues to knock, felicity shows its smiling face. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We conclude this amazing presentation. We're really on another plane. And I wish you a very nice evening. Thank you.